Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's off to a good start. Coming up a little bit later, it's politics. We got a whole crew. We have so much in politics to talk about. We've added extra experts. Try saying that fast. Experts to join us a little bit later this hour. But we begin with our daily update on COVID-19. As more and more people are coming out into the world after being in their bubbles, we'll talk about what we anticipate seeing in the number of COVID-19 cases. We'll talk about various treatments that are being studied, as well as progress on a vaccine. We're so glad to have joining us once more, Professor of Medicine, Infectious Disease Specialist from UC San Francisco Medical Center, Dr. Peter Chin Hong. So good, Doctor, to have you with us again on Air Talk.
Always a pleasure, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
Are you getting out in the world more yourself these days?
With some trepidation. So, I always wanted to keep my tradition of going outdoors. So I've always done that a little bit. But in terms of takeout, I've been doing that a little bit more. Probably not so courageous as to do in restaurant dining as yet.
Okay, so not ready. I was looking at an interesting poll about what epidemiologists are willing to do now, what they had anticipated time frame for when they're going to feel safe to go out and do things. And it was interesting to me because one of the things that the epidemiologists said was that they wouldn't be ready to go do indoor dining in a restaurant for probably many months down the road. And sounds like you're reluctant to do that, too, even with spacing indoors.
Yeah, I'm just a little bit nervous. I mean, I could imagine myself going in an outdoor setting. And in fact, over the weekend, we went to Wine Country, and you know, some of those restaurants are open for indoors now. I think in the outdoor setting, it's wide and open, and I feel a little bit more courageous about staying there. So I think, it depends on the restaurant. And I've noticed that some restaurants are very small, and even with trying to reduce capacity by 50%, it still doesn't feel right to me.
Yeah, I understand. And we're all envious now that you were up in Napa Valley or in Wine Country over the weekend. That sounds wonderful. Are you anticipating that we're going to see a spike in hospitalizations as a result of so many people being out because just, you know, businesses are restarting, first of all, and then secondly, we've had over a week now of large-scale protests?
Yes, I mean, I think it's undoubtedly a possibility that we will see a spike in cases. I think the real million-dollar question is whether or not our hospital resources will be able to keep up with that increase in cases, and hopefully they will, because, again, this is, again, a sliding scale kind of situation. So if public health officials can react to, you know, as cases increase and scale back on restrictions, that's going to be the key. If people wait too long, it will be, again, too many people out there with disease spreading rapidly, like bombs going off, and then it may be too late.
I was talking with someone who said, well, now it's been more than a week since the first large protests. You know, shouldn't we start seeing something? But I thought, well, maybe it's going to be longer delayed because most of the people at the protest, not all, but the majority are young. So it would seem to me that it would be in their interactions over the next couple of weeks with older people that you would be likely to see those sorts of cases that would be visible. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, it's partially correct, Larry. I think that young people are not immune from getting sick. But you're right, the people who may get seriously ill would be folks who are older. And also, like you pointed out, there would be a lag time between, you know, these large-scale gatherings and when people would actually turn positive. The other caveat is I've noticed, at least depending on the area, more people in these large-scale gatherings or protesting are actually wearing masks. So, again, there would be heterogeneity and the effect of those large-scale gatherings, as well as, like, based on the prevalence in the area, on what the impact on cases would be in 2 weeks.
I was surprised at seeing some of the differences in how people, where you see people wearing masks and others won't. I was at Long Beach yesterday, and I was walking along the pedestrian jogging path there, and my family and I were among the only ones masked as we're walking along. Very few other people were wearing masks as they were riding bikes, rollerblading, walking out there. I'm used to, you know, the neighborhood where I am, where people are quite conscientious about masking. And what is your sense about that? Is a part of it just when people are out recreating, they just don't want the vestiges of the idea, you know, what came with the coronavirus, and they want to feel free? Or do you think that there's something else that's at play there?
I mean, I think there are multiple things. I mean, I think on the coast, people probably feel a little bit more courageous. They want to recapture that life that they remembered from pre-COVID days. But I do notice that in some areas, even California, people are mandating masks. Like even in the farmer's market, again, when we went to wine country this weekend, there was a farmer's market in Napa. And even though it was outdoors in a parking lot and they were limiting the number of people there, they mandated that everyone wear a mask. So I think in those situations, depending on the sensitivity and the, you know, how forward thinking the organizers are, It was very heartwarming to see that happen. We do know that there's some data, and speaking to my colleagues around the country, that it seems that a lot of folks who are wearing masks are on the coast. They're kind of in cities. They're a little bit, they may be more educated versus countryside. There may be some impact on politics, on the ability to wear masks. So all of these things are afoot. And it's really interesting for me talking to my colleagues around the country as to what people are doing in different parts.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Chin Hong, joining us from San Francisco, where he is a professor at UC San Francisco. He's at the medical center there and also an infectious disease specialist. So, Chaz, for you to ask him any questions about the coronavirus, COVID-19, 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. So here's a shift. We heard initially with the coronavirus that ibuprofen may compromise an individual's health, make the person more susceptible to the effects of COVID-19. Now we hear it's being tested as a possible treatment for symptoms. What happened, Dr. Chin Hong?
I know. Well, first of all, I never really believed that first report about ibuprofen being wrong for COVID-19. It didn't make any sense to me. There wasn't enough data, and of course, we found out later it was just based on rumors and actually fake news that was circulating on the WhatsApp messaging app, spurred on by a bunch of people that was responsible for the WHO making that initial announcement, which they one day later retracted. Now, thinking of it as cure seems to be like 100, or moderating disease seems like a 180-degree turn. And again, I'm not sort of like embracing it either. I mean, I continue to take ibuprofen. I mean, a lot of COVID-19 gives me a headache anyway in terms of what's happening around the country. But I think in terms of embracing it fully, I think we really need to wait for data. And much of the narrative of COVID-19 research, as you know, has been people jumping on data too fast. And I think we really just have to be circumspect about the whole thing. It's interesting. It may make sense because it impacts the receptors, those ACE2 receptors that COVID-19 likes to land on, that's the bed, before it kind of exerts its negative impacts. So if it impacts on that, maybe there is a way it modulates infection or progression of disease. But again, it's too early to tell. I would say conservatively that it's no reason to not take it, but I wouldn't say it's a reason to take it because you think it's going to help you.
While we're talking about medications, the Lancet article on hydroxychloroquine that was highly influential, which concluded there were serious harms by taking that drug for people with COVID-19. That article has now been retracted by the Lancet. So where are we on hydroxychloroquine?
I still am not enthusiastic about it. Actually, what has not been published is actually some other data showing that, you know, there's the VA cooperative data where there's also a signal of danger. But I think people are very cautious about, again, publishing that before rigorous peer review. But again, it doesn't make sense to me that it's you're using a malaria or rheumatoid arthritis drug for a virus. Again, we haven't really treated a virus properly without using an antiviral drug. And again, there's no reason that hydroxychloroquine will be great for the inflammatory part of the illness, which is where ibuprofen and some of these other agents come in. So again, you know, I'll wait for the data, but I'm not going to rush out and buy any or take any stores for my rheumatoid arthritis patients.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Chin Hong, UC San Francisco School of Medicine and Medical Center, 866-893-KPECC, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Rob in Long Beach. You're on AirTalk.
Sure. I have a question about what guidelines recommend, or whether there are guidelines that recommend wearing masks or coverings when people are outdoors recreating, such as you, what Larry said you were doing in Long Beach, which I live in Long Beach and we don't have a requirement that you wear masks outside. And the new World Health Organization recommendations for masks recommend you wear them when you cannot maintain social distancing. They don't seem to suggest you wear them when you're out riding a bike or running or walking and you are just passing by people. So.
Yeah, I guess what I was seeing was people were not maintaining social distancing. When I walk in my neighborhood, I don't wear a mask because it's a suburban area. I don't come within 10 feet of anyone, let alone 6 feet. But on the pedestrian path in Long Beach, because people move at different rates, there's no way for me to keep that distance at all times. So that's why in that setting, I chose to wear a mask. But Dr. Chin Hong, you want to talk about best practices, please?
Totally. I mean, I'd say if you don't know what situation you're going into, it's safe to carry a mask with you. Again, it's not really about whether you have a mask or you can do social distancing. It's whether or not you can control your environment. So when Larry's walking in a suburban area, you know, there's not a lot of people around, and it's fine not to wear. If you're in a farm in Mendocino, it doesn't make sense to wear a mask and think of that as an all or none. Again, in most cases, when you're running or recreating, if there are not a lot of people around, sure, it doesn't make sense to wear a mask unless you want to, you know, avoid the stares of people who are looking at you sort of with evil eye, which is what some of my colleagues started doing. They started wearing masks just because they didn't want to take the people's eyes when they ran by them quickly. But anyway, in a crowded area, like on a pedestrian boardwalk, even if you're outdoors and there are tons of people around, again, you can't really control your environment. So I would say wear a mask. It's not whether or not you're on the beach or you're not on the beach. It's whether or not you can control your environment.
I appreciate your call, Rob. Thank you very much. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. What are we learning about blood type or genetics and its potential interaction with severity or vulnerability to even contract COVID-19?
Yeah, these are really fast, very emerging topics right now. And I think there is no consensus, although there's been some intriguing data, both from the Italians a few weeks ago about blood type A being a negative risk factor for progression, not for just getting the disease. It's like of the people who got it and they got on a ventilator, they tended to have more blood type A's. And then recently there was one from 23andMe saying that if you had blood type O, you were protected. But again, these are very, very crude measures. And I think over time, we will probably understand some finer aspects about what these very crude measures represent at a much more refined genetic level. And that's very difficult. And that gets to the point of what contribution does genetics, if it at all plays something, it probably does play a part in progression, but how much it plays depends on the context. You know, I personally probably think that structural racism or access to healthcare probably plays a bigger role. Some environmental factors play a bigger role than genetics. But again, we're not really sure. At the end of the day, it's probably a combination of environment and genetics, like with many things in healthcare, that impacts, you know, how someone progresses. And of course, as we know, in the East Coast versus West Coast, it's about surge capacity. So it doesn't matter what your genetics are, if the hospital doesn't have enough ICU beds to take care of you, a lot of people are going to, unfortunately, not do well.
Ron, in the city of Orange, thank you for joining us. Your question, please.
My question is about testing. A lot of hospitals are using both the PCR test and the rapid test. The PCR is supposed to be more effective, so I'm trying to figure out why some hospitals are still continuing to use a rapid test. And second part of my question was, some states, they're cutting back on testing and they're seeing an increase in unexplained pneumonia deaths or heart disease related deaths, and trying to see if there's a correlation between patients not being tested enough.
All right, Ron, thanks.
Those are such great questions from Ron. I mean, first of all, with the issue of testing, I think our hospital system, we've kind of shied away from the rapid. Many of these rapid tests are antigen-based testing or other sort of more rapid tests because of, you know, not having enough sensitivity. I think the pros originally for that kind of testing was that, they could be cheaper, they could be rolled out in a much more wide-scale way. But I think that initial enthusiasm has been kind of tempered by exactly what was brought up, which is they're not that sensitive. So you'll have a bunch of people with false negatives, and that wouldn't be great. So I think we're kind of stuck in, at least in our hospital system, for the traditional sort of almost like you're getting a brain biopsy, nasal pharyngeal swab. For now, because it's a little bit better test.
Brain biopsy. It is pretty extreme. I haven't had it, but people I know have had it. It's pretty extreme.
The last time I got it, yeah.
Yeah, feel like they're removing a part of your head. Dr. Peter Chin Ong with us, UC San Francisco Medical Center. Again, we're taking your calls at 866-893-KPECC. Our latest on COVID-19 coming up in about 10 minutes. We'll talk politics as we do every Monday, and we've expanded our team of analysts because we have a lot to cover. COVID-19, its political dimensions, and of course the protests against police brutality and racism across the country. We'll talk about the politics of that too. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC, the KPECC app, and any type of smart speaker from Amazon, Google, or others. All you have to do is tell it, play KPECC, and there we are with you in every room in your house. So you don't have to be out driving around. You can be right there in your home safety bubble and listening to KPCC all day and all night. With me right now is Dr. Peter Chin Ong, who's become a real favorite among Air Talk listeners, UC San Francisco Medical Center professor, as well as infectious disease specialist. We're at 866-893-KPCC, the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. You can also tweet a question at Air Talk or post it on the Air Talk Facebook page. Wanted to ask you, since we were talking about medication, how useful are antibiotics to treat the symptoms of COVID-19?
Not useful at all. In fact, there's some good data now showing that people overuse antibiotics at the beginning. I think it was a little bit understandable in the beginning of COVID. People were nervous about all these patients coming in, and they weren't really sure if it was just COVID or if it was COVID plus. As the epidemic moved on, we realized it was mainly just COVID and there weren't a lot of things. Because even in our hospital system, we were doing a lot of diagnostics of people, and it remained primarily just the virus without bacteria. So there wasn't really any need to unleash regular antibiotics. And of course, we know that when we overuse antibiotics, we lose them because we get more resistant. So I think that's kind of like the question, particularly in people who are not very ill, which is the most cases of people who have COVID. Actually, they're mild or moderate or have mild symptoms. So for sure, those people don't need a Z-Pak with sort of reassurance. They just need the reassurance and following up to see if they get sick.
Chelsea in Altadena says, when do you predict that we'll hit herd immunity, and how do you develop that if physical distancing continues to be enforced?
So that's a great question from Chelsea. So the quick answer to that question is we would not get herd immunity until we have the vaccine. We will never get to a place where we have 70% of people infected to protect the 30% who may not be protected. That's what Sweden was thinking. They were thinking, well, we'll not enforce shelter in place, and let's just make sure everybody kind of got exposed a little bit, kind of like the old chickenpox party that you had for your kids in the old days. But that wasn't the case. In fact, Sweden, as people may know, had the highest numbers of cases in Scandinavia, and in 1 week had even higher numbers of cases than England. So I think that experiment, natural experiment, didn't work. The Swedes are reevaluating their policy, and I don't think we'll have herd immunity until we have the vaccine.
Heard from a lot of listeners who've taken part in protests over the last week plus who want to know, should they get tested for COVID-19 because they've been out in close contact with people at the protests? Should that be routine for people who've attended?
That's a great question. And some states have been more stern in their recommendations or encouraging. So in New York, as people may know, Governor Cuomo said it was a people's civic duty to get tested. I'm kind of like in between, meaning that if people were, again, it's just a matter of how you assess your risk. Were you wearing a mask? Did you have to like take off your mask to shout and then you were at risk to other people? Were you like touching your face a lot because you can't really wash your hands or use hand sanitizer enough in the field? In those cases, I would say it probably isn't a bad idea to get tested. I'm always a proponent of getting tested because, again, the more we know what's going on in the community, the better we can protect the other people who are negative. And it does give you a little bit of assurance. The only problem is, of course, we don't know when people turn positive. I would say you wait at least a week, follow your symptoms, you know, maybe get a test of the week if you didn't protect yourself out in the field, and then, you know, continue to watch yourself if you're negative.
Jeffrey, writing on the AirTalk page, brings up the contrast with Las Vegas, and he raises the concern that there, unlike protests where people are typically local, you have people coming from all different places who could potentially take COVID-19 back to their communities. I know that the casino hotels that have reopened are attempting to enforce 6-foot physical distancing, but not everybody is masking. And, you know, who knows how hard they're going to have to go after people are drinking and gambling and whatnot to keep people apart. So do you have concerns about Vegas essentially being a breeding ground for the virus?
I have 1,000,000% concern about Vegas. I've seen some of those pictures on social media. Many of these settings, as we know, are indoors, which is much riskier for COVID than being in the outdoors, which we've talked about a lot so far in this, you know, in this hour. Again, people coming from all over the place. You have alcohol involved. You have a lot of emotion. People are joyful. You get back into that casino mode, and you kind of become a different person when the world wasn't in the COVID situation. So I guess for all those situations, I worry a lot about Las Vegas. And time will tell what will be the aftermath.
JSK asks on the page, are there any good studies about plasma antibody treatments yet?
No great randomized controlled studies, but there are studies showing that it's safe in COVID-19 with not a lot of side effects. In fact, our experience in Northern California supports that study where, you know, I've actually had zero side effects in our patients by giving convalescent plasma. And as we know, we've had this long history in infectious disease of giving people's antibodies for different infections, as early as polio, and then SARS and MERS, hepatitis A. So I think it's safe. There's good biologic plausibility that it works. We just don't have the specific COVID data yet.
I want to thank you as always, Doctor. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to us talking in a few days more. Thank you again.
Thanks so much, Larry. Bye.
All right, bye-bye. We affectionately call him Dr. PCH here. Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine at UCSF Medical Center. We just have some news out of Minneapolis. A judge there has set $1 million bail for the Minneapolis police officer charged with second-degree murder in George Floyd's death. 44-year-old Derek Chauvin said almost nothing during an 11-minute hearing in which he appeared before Hennepin County Judge Denise Riley on closed-circuit TV from the state's maximum security prison in Oak Park Heights. His attorney did not contest the bail, which has been raised from the $500,000 initially set in the case. Also, his attorney did not address the substance of the charges, which also include third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC.